All right, good evening. I'd like to call the House Ways and Means Committee to order. Today is April 26th, 2023. Let the record reflect the 6:03 p.m. Today we have present Speaker Tilton, Representative McKay, Representative McCabe, Representative Groh, Representative Gray, and myself, Chair Carpenter. All right, please remind everybody to silence their cell phones. Kevin Allen with House Records will be assisting us this evening, and Zach Lawhorn with the LIO will also be assisting. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here. My staff, Kendra Broussard, will be here to assist the committee. Today on the agenda, we have a presentation from Legislative Finance. This is a follow-up to questions that the committee had posed in previous committee meetings. This is specifically on economic impacts of our revenue measures that are before us. Questions were asked regarding distribution analysis and regional analysis, and so we're going to have a conversation about that tonight. Also, let the record reflect that Representative Aldard is here. Dr. Painter, Mr. Bell, if you will come forward and put yourselves on the record and begin your presentation, I would appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division.
For the record, Connor Bell, Legislative Finance Division.
And I'm going to kick it off and then turn it over to Connor for the first few slides. So we were asked to cover three basic things. The first was a comparison of sales and income tax revenue projections from various sources. So we've seen projections by the Department of Revenue as well as a number of outside groups. We're trying to compare those and see why they differ, and maybe provide some insight there. We're going to do some distributional analysis of the impact of broad-based taxes and PFD change by income levels, and then we will do some regional analysis of how these might affect people in different regions of the state, which we have somewhat limited data, so we'll discuss that as well. And just a note that we're not advocating for any policy plan or measure by being here. We're just presenting the information that's been provided by other groups mainly. I'll turn it over to Mr. Bell for the next few slides.
For the record, Connor Bell, Legislative Finance Division. Slide 3 compares different models of sales tax in Alaska and how they differ. First is Department of Revenue. They are contracting with Chainbridge, which is a company that provides sales tax services to other states and therefore have microdata for other states, which they're basing this model on. They developed estimates for 4 sales tax proposals based on 2019 to 2020 data. DOR then took that data and adjusted it to today using nationwide retail sales growth. And the prior DOR models before working with Chainbridge was based on the personal consumption expenditure data from the Bureau of Economic Analysis, and the results are relatively similar once you adjust for the retail sales growth over time to basically bring it up, account for inflation and changing in spending over time. However, the Chainbridge modeling allows for a much more detailed analysis of exemptions since they have this pretty thorough and detailed microdata. And then Department of Revenue sales tax projections, they also assume revenue growth of 3% a year. 2.5% of that is based on Callan's inflation assumption, and the other 0.5% is based on Department of Labor's population growth forecast. The Buckeye Institute, they were in their 2019 study, they used a 2016 fiscal note for Alaska's House Bill 5004. And they took that fiscal note and adjusted it for impacts to consumer industry behavior, which results in their model of an 18% reduction from the static estimate in the DOR fiscal note. And finally, the Tax Foundation, they're also using the BEA personal consumption expenditure data, which Department of Revenue was using in the past. They are using it to estimate both the tax base and the exemption, since personal consumption expenditure data breaks out the types of goods or services purchased. They also are assuming an 85% collections rate, meaning that of the goods and services subject to the tax, 85% of those purchases would actually result in taxes collected. And once you, that's estimate from the Tax Foundation is 43% lower than Department of Revenue's estimate. And once you account for the growth in retail sales over that period, and also that account for the 85% collections rate, you get back to essentially what Department of Revenue is estimating. So they all, once you make those adjustments, they all have pretty similar assumptions, in part because they've been working off similar data sources due to the limited availability of public data.
Can you go back one slide there? The acronym BEA, is that Bureau of Economic Analysis or something like that? What's the definition of that?
Chart Carpenter, yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. One other question. The assumptions for growth, especially with a sales tax that's consumption-based, are the models counting for continued population decline, or how are they addressing the population of the state?
Chair Carpenter, the most recent Department of Labor population projections they're projecting population growth going forward, that it's basically the recent declines are reversing. And so based on those Department of Labor projections, we're assuming population growth through the forecast period, slight growth.
Thank you. Please continue.
Slide 4 compares different income tax models. Again, due to the limited availability of public data, they're all using similar data sources, so relatively similar estimates, and I'll just get in a little bit into why they differ somewhat. The Department of Revenue is using the most recent IRS Statistics of Income data, Internal Revenue Service data for calendar year 2020 tax returns. And they use a 5% non-resident adjustment, meaning that it's adjusting the estimates upwards by 5% to account for the non-Alaska residents paying income tax for Alaska, working in Alaska, minus Alaska residents working and earning income elsewhere. So that's where that 5% adjustment is coming from. Again, they're scaling this up to account for the data being from 2020. Here they're using a 20% scaling for wage growth from 2020 to today. And then going forward, they're again using that same 3% per year growth assumption, which is 2.5% for inflation and 0.5% for population growth. The Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, again, is using a very similar methodology to DOR, except since this is an older study, they're using 2018 rather than 2020 IRS data. And then the Buckeye Institute is using their static model is very similar to a 2018 DOR estimate, again, based on that IRS data. And then they are adjusting for impacts on consumer and industry behavior, which we'll get into later in a later slide.
Please continue.
All right, slide 5 discusses dynamic revenue modeling, which is estimating how a policy change can impact how businesses and individuals behave. And Buckeye is currently the only publicly available source that is doing this dynamic modeling in comparison to static modeling, which makes no assumption for changes in consumer industry behavior. And in Buckeye's dynamic modeling, they estimate, for instance, a sales tax that once you account for those dynamic impacts of behavior changes, the revenue declines by 18% compared to just the static analysis. And Department of Revenue's tax collection, their projections have always been using the static analysis because basically it's very difficult to objectively predict how taxpayers and businesses will react to any changes. And in the past, and this was a subject of a lot of debate over, for instance, oil taxes, because it's a situation where it's, while it is absolutely possible that tax changes can affect industry behavior, for instance, it is just, it's becomes very difficult to actually quantify that.
Does the dynamic revenue modeling also account or compare, I guess, the income tax as well, or just the sales tax?
Chair Carpenter, yes. They do look at a flat income tax and a progressive income tax, and applying the dynamic modeling lowers their flat income tax assumption by 15%. So basically accounting for those changes in behavior lowers the revenue collected by 15%. With the progressive tax on their modeling, it's a much larger 43% decline. So with a progressive tax, once you account for the changes in behavior, 43% less revenue is collected. And it's that particular progressive tax has a top marginal tax rate of 7% of taxable income.
Thank you. Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Mr. Bell. So you could, through the chair, can you just kind of run through that again with me for clarity? So it seems to me you said that Buckeye's dynamic modeling indicates an 18% decline in revenue because we instituted a sales tax. And the flat tax was a 15% decrease in revenue because people would leave is what we're talking about, right? And you said that the income tax, progressive income tax, at 7% rate would cause how many, what kind of decline in revenue?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, it's 43%, so much higher than the 15% of the flat income tax based on Buckeye's estimates. And basically, part of that seems to be due to higher income earners being able to basically having a greater incentive to basically minimize their tax liability.
Representative.
So what you really mean is greater income earners have a better ability or a higher ability to be able to move out of state, essentially, and not pay the progressive income tax.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, I don't want to speak too confidently about their analysis, but I believe they are assuming basically that there is greater change in behavior from higher income earners in their analysis.
Thanks.
Representative Groh.
I understand you're just describing models. Does that seem right to you? I mean, I mean, you know, given that, you know, if I recall, over 40 states have income taxes. I mean, it's that this is the only state that has neither a broad and no form of broad-based tax, and that more than 2/3 of the states have both a personal income tax and a statewide sales tax at general application. Does that seem right to you? I mean, I'm just, you know, I mean, I understand you're presenting what this model says.
So that's a good question. Maybe instead of, if I can turn it into a quantifiable question, I get what you're, the question you're asking is this individual, our guest, does he agree with this? I would like to know if there's data out there that supports or refutes what the analysis might say. What has happened in other states?
Chair Carpenter, for the record, Alexi Painter, Loves Finance. I'll take this one. I think from what we've looked at, the 15 to 18% range is more standard than the 43% range, but I'm not sure that there's an objective sort of data review of what would be an accepted, generally accepted number. I would just say that 43% seems unusually high to me, but again, that's what their analysis shows, and I don't want to speak for why they have that result.
I guess to help Representative Groh's train of thought here, I don't know whether 43% is accurate either. I do know that there are quite a few states that have high income taxes that have an outward migration of people and have for a number of years. That doesn't speak to the correct number, but just to say, does it feel right or does it seem right that a behavior would, I don't know. I can't speak to the number, but he didn't ask me to answer the question, but I guess I'm trying to answer it with my opinion.
Chair Carpenter, the other thing I would say with that is just that I lost my train of thought. Actually, I will not comment.
Right. Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I would find it quite shocking if any state instituted a progressive income tax and 43% of the higher earners moved away that year. Thank you.
say, can you say that again?
Yes. I would find it shocking if there was evidence in the historical record that a state had instituted a progressive income tax and 43% of the higher earners moved out of state that year. That's my comment.
Representative McCabe and then Representative McKay.
Thank you, Chair Carpenter. So to be clear, that 43% doesn't, and I kind of led us down this rabbit trail by saying people might move out of state, but there's other ways that they can shelter their money. When you have enough money to hire a couple of fine gentlemen like you that talk in financial things, or you can absolutely find ways to shelter or otherwise remove your 43% or whatever the amount of money that you contribute that's part of that 43% to remove it from the revenue that we're gaining. So we're not just talking about moving out of state. We're talking about people that know how to do this. And frankly, I wouldn't find it shocking at all coming from a military background and having lived in several states that have high income taxes. I would absolutely move out of state. Not that I'm a high earner, but.
Thank you. Representative McKay. Well,
yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to say that they will find ways to shelter. They will invest in things to reduce their tax liability. They will change their behavior. And that could get you up to the 43%. They may not all move, but they'll change their behavior. They'll do things to not have to pay a lot of tax.
So rather than us getting too focused on what the percentage is, maybe, and I'll come to you, Representative Allard, maybe we just acknowledge that there is a behavior change that isn't a positive one for the state revenue in regards. Representative Allard.
Can I make a political statement?
Are there any other kinds?
And point well made, because as soon as we do an income tax, your state turns blue. Okay. There you go. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Allard.
You're welcome.
Please continue with your presentation.
For the record, Connor Bell, Legislative Finance. Slide 6 attempts to show or illustrate the impact on four different hypothetical households. Each household has four members, and we have just basically four different households, one with $25,000 a year of what we're here at adjusted gross income, $50,000, $100,000, or $200,000. And we're comparing three different policy changes, each which generate roughly $640 million. The first is a 4% broad-based sales tax, which exempts groceries. We're basing it on the Minnesota sales tax simply because they have publicly available analysis of their the distributional impact of their sales tax using actual data. So that's why we're basing it off Minnesota here. The income tax is 1.9% of adjusted gross income, and this assumes a flat tax with no deductions. And then last is a $1,000 per person PFD reduction. And again, these all result in revenue of about $640 million. And we're using a lot of simplifying assumptions here. So just to note that basically these are rough approximations. For the 4% sales tax, the impact would be greater on lower income households as a percentage of income, because lower income families tend to spend a greater proportion of their income each month. The for the income tax, the impact would be the same for families of $25,000, $50,000, and $100,000 per year. The $200,000 per year family pays a slightly lower percentage, just because here we're assuming that higher income family is able to itemize that tax against their federal tax liability. And then the $1,000 PFD reduction has a higher impact on the lower income families. we're assuming here that basically the reason why it's not showing $4,000 for every family is because basically we're assuming that these PFDs otherwise would have been subjected to federal income tax at that family's marginal tax rate.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, can you just explain how a $1,000 reduction in the PFD is an impact of $4,000 $3,500, $3,500, $3,000. I think, to me, if you, I mean, someone's explaining, I don't understand. If you take $1,000 off, oh, is it because there's four people in the family? Thank you.
And the reduction in the amount going down the chart is due to the taxation at the federal tax level.
Gotcha.
Very good. Yes. Good.
Mr. Chairman, to maybe jump in with context why we're doing it this way. So I think like about 8 years ago, there was not much of this data available. And so at the Legislative Finance Division, we were looking into, well, how can we do some distributional analysis in a way that is easier for people to understand than using quintiles or deciles or something like that, that is, I think, is rather abstract. So we published an analysis then that essentially is just using hypothetical families of various sizes, and we're just picking that family of four as one of those, but essentially just trying to make it into a more understandable version to people than the deciles. We'll show some ICER analysis in a couple of slides that does that more detailed analysis, but this is really kind of a simplified analysis just to try to make it a little easier for people to put that to an understandable family. So, you know, I know it's kind of arbitrary that we've picked these income levels and then a family of four, but we're just trying to put it in kind of relatable terms.
Thank you, Representative Painter. I think it was a good choice.
Again, for the record, Connor Bell, Legislative Finance. Moving on to slide 7, it's just noting basically additional considerations with these distributional analysis that we were just showing three potential policy proposals, but if you had basically made changes to those structures, it would have significantly different impacts distributionally. For instance, if you added a deduction of $10,000 or however many thousand dollars to the income tax, it would look a lot different, or added a progressive rate structure. And then for the sales tax, adding in deductions based on basically which things are deducted and how those are consumed by people of lower versus higher incomes, it could have a significant impact on how the prior chart looks.
Please continue.
Slide 8 shows a 2016 study by economists at the Institute of Social and Economic Research at the University of Alaska Anchorage. And they looked at the distributional impacts of different revenue changes, and they're also looking at the indirect impacts of basically the second order effects of how activity in the state has changed as a result of these revenue measures. And the chart below shows the impact on disposable income per $100 million raised, not the total impact. So for instance, the yellow bars in the chart showing the $600 PFD and cut in PFD, it's a little confusing. That is actually per $100 million. So the yellow bars represent roughly $150 per person PFD cut. So basically this table is showing the relative impact of disposable income at the individual level. Also that since this was in a 2016 study, it doesn't account for the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which significantly changed the federal tax structure. But you can see that the PFD cut, equal to about $100 million, is about the poorest 10% of people is somewhere around a 3.3% reduction in their disposable income. The richest 10% of people, it's about a tenth of a percent or less. And then otherwise, the rates are, you'll see lower numbers than in the prior table we showed, mostly because the amount of revenue is $100 million, which is much lower than the revenue assumed in the prior slide.
It seems just observationally here that basically from your 50th to your 90th percentile, all of the different options are fairly equally distributed. To add a level of complexity, this probably doesn't address this, but we're considering multiple options and not just one option. This chart here clearly shows an either-or option between different tax proposals, if you will, or tax options. But what would the distribution analysis be if the let's just say the permanent fund dividend was applied, the cut wasn't applied, because that's part of the options that we had that we're going through here, and then you implemented a sales tax or an income tax, what would the distributional analysis be with the, both of those combined? Because if there's such a large negative distributional analysis at the lower levels with the PFD, but it is no longer there, then logically it should be added into the increase on one of the other tax options.
Chair Carpenter, that's a great question. I think that's a great illustration of kind of the limitations of this analysis is the any option to close the deficit is going to have an impact to the economy and an impact to potentially to private incomes. The only option that does not have an impact is just spending out of savings. That has no short-term impact. But there, anything that goes from spending $1 billion of from the CBR, for example, that you know is not sustainable over the long term but has no economic impact, versus taking that $1 billion out of the economy is going to have an impact. So really you're comparing those things. So if you're comparing, well, one option would be we would have a $1 billion higher dividend or $500 million higher dividend than we might otherwise, and then other things may act in the opposite direction. You could combine those. The question is compared to what? Compared to the reality of what? I suppose the question is what would we do otherwise? Spend from savings, cut the PFD. What is the default proposal that you're comparing to? So it's easy to say in theory a 2% sales tax does this, a reduction of the PFD. But the question is a reduction to the PFD from what? If you're trying to figure out the net impact of your entire suite of policy options, I think that's been the challenge that we've had of doing distributional analysis in the past. Is what do we compare this to? What is the status quo? We don't know, because it sort of changes every year what the legislature does. And I think that's the difficulty this committee gets to wrestle with is what are you comparing this to? And then perhaps you could stack some of these bars to get an idea of the net result of your package of bills.
And thank you, Mr. Painter. Representative McCabe and then Representative Groh.
Thank you. So Mr. Painter, I mean, you made a statement that kind of triggered me. We also can't know. You said taking $1 billion out of the economy. We can't know what effect that has. So what you mean is removing that amount of a PFD from the people that would be spending that in our economy at businesses that then also end up paying the state for their taxes and all that sort of stuff, right? So we can't know that other leg of the equation really because you have no real baseline. But there is an impact. Right, I mean the multiplier effect of the private money into the economy, right?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe. Yes. So the ICER study also looked at those short run economic impacts of not just these revenue options, but also budget options, and sort of tried to get an approximation of what is the different impact of various things we could do to close the deficit, whether it's if we're cutting state employees. Those individuals lose their jobs, so that'd be an economic impact, but then also their spending would go away. If you cut the PFD, that would reduce less sharply to people because they're not directly losing their jobs, but that money's still coming out of the economy. All of these options would take the money out of the economy in some way. The question is, what is the multiplier on the economy, and then what's the distributional analysis? And that's what that ICER study was really trying to get at in 2016, was to compare those options on those fronts.
Representative Groh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, are there other differences between the ICER methodology in the study from 2016 and the Legislative Finance Division's methodology in the sense of the comparison of page 6 and page 8 in these graphics? And are there other differences that are useful to note for the committee and the methodologies?
Through the chair, Representative Groh, yes, the study by the ICER economists is much more thorough, and basically they were using, I believe it was Remy, but they were using more detailed economic modeling to basically look at these secondary impacts. And so not just our analysis on slide 6 was a very simple illustrative model where this goes more into depth with the actual reverberating effects in the economy.
Thank you.
Please continue. All right, Mr. Chairman, Alexi Painter for the record. I'm going to take over the next the next few slides on the impacts by geographic region. So any fiscal policy change we could make would be felt differently across Alaska. Due to limited data, it is difficult to estimate the regional differences. So an income tax and a PFD are actually relatively easy to compare across geographic areas in some level because we have detailed income data. We know what the median income is in various communities in Alaska. On the other hand, sales taxes are very difficult to compare across geographic regions because of the differences in consumption patterns. And we'll get into that a little more in the next few slides. So the next few slides, we're going to go into different ways of potentially illustrating the regional differences, but all of them have limitations. We wish that we had a data source that where somebody studied the actual consumption patterns of residents of various communities in the state. That doesn't exist. The closest thing is some data by the U.S. military, which we'll talk about in one of these future slides. But that gold standard data that's actually exactly what we're looking for here does not exist. So it's we can't quite get a real answer to the question. We'll just sort of skirt around it in a number of ways. The Alaska Economic Trends Annual Cost of Living Issue, that's published by the Department of Labor, provides more detail in comparing costs across communities, which also may be useful. Some of the difficulty is figuring out how much of those costs do people actually experience. So if you're a resident of a community, you may do some of your shopping in your community. You may do some of it in a nearby hub community. You may do some of it in other states. You may do some of it online. And that's going to vary greatly how much you're actually experiencing the prices in your community. You know, the price of milk may be half the price in one community to another, but people likely in that community with a high milk price are not buying all of their goods from that store. And we'll see in a few slides some evidence of that. So first, we'll start with the kind of easier data on slide 10. This is the income data by region. So the Bureau of Economic Analysis has data from 2021 that shows the average amount of income for every person in a given area. And note this, that this is at the individual, not household level. And also 2021 was an unusual year because of some pandemic aid coming out from the federal government that led to high income for a lot of individuals. It does not account for differences in cost of living, distribution of income, or the significance of non-economic activity such as subsistence. One thing that that means is that we don't really have a good measure here of disposable income necessarily by region. So while we can say that, you know, a 2% income tax in Skagway is, you know, 2% of 71,000 is a higher number than 2% of 60,000 in Hoonah or Rangoon, we don't know if that's really more painful to the Skagway resident than Hoonah or Rangoon because of the differences in lifestyles and non-economic activity that make it difficult to really understand the true impact on the economy and on these individuals. However, we can at least sort of mechanically apply for an income or PFD reduction. We could see easily the percentage that applies to of people's, the median income in various regions from this data.
Representative McKay.
You sparked my interest. Who are those guys at Bristol Bay?
Chair Representative McKay, there's a lot of fishing activity there that leads to pretty high per capita personal income.
I thought they were just barely getting by out there. Okay, very interesting.
Please continue.
So I think the best source we have for looking at cost of living by region is from the U.S. Department of Defense. They track cost of living in multiple Alaska communities to account for the cost of living differences for service members stationed outside the continental U.S. The index excludes housing, which is helpful for us because just like a sales tax would not apply to housing, they're in potentially, depending on how it's structured, does not include housing. But it may not necessarily reflect consumption habits of residents. It's possible that non-resident military members
would have a significantly different consumption pattern than a resident of a community. So that's a major limitation of this data. However, the advantage is that this military data, they survey both prices and actual consumption patterns of the military members on an annual basis. So they actually ask the military members, what are you buying and where are you buying it, as well as what are the prices in your community. So some other sources we have that we will present on just have one or the other. We'll just have what is bought in a community and then what is the price. This is kind of the only thing we have that's trying to meld them together. The disadvantage, again, is that this reflects military members, not residents, and there may be substantial differences in between those two that are very difficult for us to quantify. So the way this works is that the index is 100, so that's the U.S. average for the country as a whole. The highest indexes in Alaska are Bethel and Cordova at 146, meaning that it's 46% higher than the average U.S. city. The lowest in Alaska are Anchorage and Wasilla. Those have a 28% increase over the U.S. city average. So they do find significant differences in the cost of living between communities, but again, not as much as you might expect given the level, the difference in just prices alone, because they are also adjusting for the consumption patterns where people in these isolated communities may be purchasing significant amounts of goods and services from hubs or out of state or from internet sales. And again, that may not necessarily reflect how residents consume, but it does reflect how military members consume. So this is perhaps somewhat useful data to answer this question.
So some of this kind of, this is an interesting slide because it challenges some of my preconceived notions. There are portions of the state of Alaska with higher cost of living who are on the road network than places that are not on the road network with lower cost of living, which is not what I would have expected to see.
And Mr. Chairman, one of the reasons for that that is, again, difficult is that they're also looking at the amount of on-base versus off-base expenditures. So a community like Kodiak that has a large Coast Guard base, presumably they're able to do more on-base shopping that may reduce their costs versus a place that doesn't have a base. It's very difficult for us without access to their data to know how much that's contributing to the results. But I was also surprised by the results of this.
That might work for Kodiak. It doesn't explain Nome and Barrow. Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'll just offer my own personal experience that shopping at the commissary at J-Bear isn't really that much cheaper than some of the other grocery stores in Anchorage. So I'm not sure that necessarily changes it. You disagree? In my family, it was more trouble to go on base to go to the commissary. There are a couple of things that were cheaper, but it wasn't a drastic difference. But I noticed that Bethel, you know, if you go back a slide, in Bethel has that really low income. And then on this slide, they are the highest price. Like, that discrepancy really jumped out at me. So that they're the lowest income. But then, and then this is, you just gotta teach me. I'm probably not the only person in Alaska who doesn't understand this. So Bristol Bay is 155,000 and Bethel is the lowest. And can you just teach me about that? Like, that just kind of jumps out to me as well. I mean, maybe I need to study the map better, but I feel like Bethel's not that far away. And then the second thing is that I notice, and I know it's military data, but we're not looking at villages that are off the road system. We're not, you know, these are relatively larger population centers, and we're not looking at really small population centers where we hear the stories of the incredibly high prices. So do we have any data on that? Because I think there might be something go higher than 146.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, we don't have the data from that source on that. We have kind of increasingly worse sources of data to get at the answer to this question. I would agree that, yes, we have hub communities in here, which are not necessarily representative of the much smaller communities. But to the question of, you know, the Bristol Bay Borough, again, with the fishing activity, it may be the average income is brought up significantly by certain residents who own vessels versus other residents who don't. So there may be more income inequality in some of those places. And then on places in Bethel, we'll get to in a couple of slides, there may be a difference in terms of people's consumption patterns in that more of the economy is dependent on subsistence, which is not, you know, doesn't show up in a cost of living adjustment or as income, but is part of how the people in those communities feed their families.
Representative Groh.
I just want to stress again to Mr. Representative Gray's point, and just make sure we elaborate on the communities shown in this cost of living are many times larger than the villages that are not shown. And also the villages that are not shown are often very substantially more remote and would have higher prices. Is that correct from all the anecdotal evidence and, you know, direct evidence that I've heard?
Through the chair, Representative Groh, that's correct. Those smaller communities are going to have higher prices. So that, and that's not captured here because there's not a military presence in right. A lot of those communities.
I have one additional question.
Representative Groh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Similarly, the graphics that you showed us of comparisons, going back to earlier graphics, of income and sales taxes do not represent the actual tax proposals in the bills in front of this committee, in the sense that, you know, that you have exclusions, various exemptions in the sales tax that aren't there, and you obviously have a different income tax bill than the one that is before the committee now.
Through the chair, Representative Groh, that's correct. So, you know, if we were trying to model the impacts of the bills in front of this committee, we would face the data limitation that, you know, we don't have good distributional analysis in Alaska on a sales tax because we don't have one. And that's kind of what we're getting to in a lot of these slides, that because we don't have that data right now, because we don't have the tax, there's a lot of limitations in our ability to do that analysis with any degree of confidence. So we use Minnesota's analysis because they have pretty sophisticated data and sophisticated analysis of their tax. How a different tax would apply to a very different state is a difficult question to answer.
Representative Ellard.
Thank you. So you had mentioned the follow-up that some of this could apply for subsistence. So it's not taken into account of other subsidies like federal or state ways of getting money, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ellard, I believe that the data on income includes all cash income, but then it's the non-economic sources like subsistence. You know, you're not counting the value of that subsistence resource as part of somebody's income.
And I don't know for sure, but is it counting the value if they get it? I'm going to say it again, because state assistance, like, because I don't know what the cutoffs are in some of these, like food stamps or welfare or what's that other thing called? Lower cost of like Section 8 housing or anything like that.
Through the Sheriff's Act, do you know?
Through the Chair, Representative Ellard, I can't speak to all of those, but definitely government transfer payments are included. I'm not sure, for instance, specifically for Section 8 housing. I don't believe that value is included in personal income, but I am not certain.
Madam Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And through the Chair, just to expand on the definition of the income, would that include dividends received from investment-type dividends or corporate dividends and items like that?
Through the Chair, Speaker Tilton, yes, that is correct. It would include the value of dividends and other investment income.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Mr. Chairman, the next slide, slide 12, shows the fuel cost by area to give an example of one good where there's kind of more extreme differences and where we have some data from particular smaller communities on here. We just picked some to get kind of a sample throughout the state. This is from the Alaska Department of Commerce Community and Economic Development's current community conditions, fuel prices across Alaska publication from July of 2022. This represents last winter's prices. So you can see that in Anaktuvuk Pass, which is in the North Slope borough, that borough subsidizes heating fuel, so it's $1.50 per gallon, whereas gasoline is actually much more expensive there because it's not subsidized at $7.20 per gallon. neither of us know why heating fuel is so cheap in King Cove, particularly, but if you look at some of the more urban areas like Anchorage and Fairbanks, it's in the $3 to $4 range. Bethel, it's somewhat higher, but not orders of magnitude. But then getting into more remote communities, it's perhaps twice the price in urban Alaska. Similarly, for gasoline, the price in Atka, for example, or Pilot Station is twice or more that in Juneau or Fairbanks.
Thank you.
And then getting to the subsistence point. So, you know, this is something that is difficult to quantify the impact of on people because the differences in non-cash sources that people have. So, you know, in Anchorage, the wild food harvest is about 15 pounds per person, whereas in Arctic Alaska, it's over 400 pounds per person, so a very big difference. And this gets to some of the points of, you know, to what degree are people experiencing local prices? If we look at a rural grocery store and ground beef is very high, to what degree are the people in that community purchasing ground beef versus doing subsistence activities? Subsistence activities do have a cost in terms of fuel and ammunition and other things, so they're not free. They may just be purchasing other goods. So perhaps they buy less beef but more fuel for their snow machine, right? That's part of why it's very difficult to look at just prices and turn that into an idea of how a sales tax could potentially impact different communities, because there's just vastly different economies and consumption patterns across the state, as I think this slide helps illustrate.
Thank you.
And going on to another source of information that is perhaps suggestive but doesn't get at any of these answers. So another Department of Commerce publication is Alaska Taxable. This looks at the tax collections of organized governments across the state. And one of the numbers they report is the tax base, which is the estimated total economic activity subject to a given tax. So if you look at sales taxes that local governments that have them administer, what is the tax base that they actually are administering that tax on? So it's adjusting for the differences in rates, but not necessarily in exemptions. And I think this gets to some of the difficulty here in terms of, you know, to what degree are people experiencing the prices in their own community versus in other communities? So residents in rural areas, or even not necessarily fully rural areas, often purchase goods in hub communities. So, for example, close to the chairman's home in Soldotna, the implied sales tax base is $72,000. That's likely higher than the median income in Soldotna. Yet the Kenai Peninsula borough that it's part of has a tax base of $24,000 per capita. What explains the discrepancy? Well, the box stores and the large retailers that people from outside of the community shop in are located in those hub communities that give them a much higher implied tax base than the rest of those non-hub communities. You see this with Nome having a relatively high amount as well. Nome is a hub community for many villages, so people from the villages around will do a portion of their shopping in Nome. And this gets to a lot of the challenges we have. So a person who lives in Anchorage likely does their shopping mostly in Anchorage or online. Maybe they go outside and do some of their shopping there. A person who lives in, say, Haines in southeast Alaska may do some of their shopping in Haines, some of their shopping in Juneau, some of their shopping on the internet. A person who lives in, say, Hooper Bay on here may do some of their shopping in Hooper Bay, some of their shopping in Bethel, some of their shopping in Anchorage, and some of their shopping online. They're experiencing a mix of prices of perhaps four different regions. And so it's very difficult to look at any one source of prices and conclude that that means that that's what people would actually pay under a sales tax, as this shows. A lot of rural communities show these incredibly low tax basis, and that's because people only do a portion of their shopping there, then they do a portion in their hub community, and then a portion in Anchorage. Anchorage does not have a sales tax, so we don't have them as one of the ones here, but I'm sure they also, Anchorage has a larger tax base than its population itself because it serves as a hub community. Then another factor is visitors and seasonal workers. So in, for example, Unalaska and Juneau, there are visitor industries that contribute significantly to the sales tax base without being residents. Or in Unalaska, it's not visitors, it's seasonal workers primarily, where they may not be full-time residents, but for part of the year, people come and work there, or people who are working on fishing vessels stop in Unalaska to resupply. So they have a implied sales tax base of $100,000, which obviously is probably much higher than many people's income there, but again, because of the seasonal workers. That makes it, again, difficult to just look at any one source of data and conclude that, well, the impact of a sales tax in this region is X, because you can see that even with existing sales taxes, there are huge regional differences that are a result of consumption patterns, not necessarily the underlying economy.
Question from Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, so Heidelberg's really low per capita. I'm just asking because I'm curious, is it because they don't have a store there, so they drive somewhere else on Prince of Wales Island and shop somewhere else? And if there is no store at all, is that internet purchases?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, I have not been to Heidelberg in many years, so I don't want to speak too confidently. I believe it is not on the road system of Prince of Wales, and you have to fly to Ketchikan, so people are purchasing goods in Ketchikan. I don't want to be too confident in that statement, whether they are part of the road system with Craig and Klawak on Prince of Wales. I believe they are not. But Thorn Bay is for sure on Prince of Wales. And Thorn Bay, interestingly, is an example of kind of a mini hub. It is the hub for some even smaller communities, but it also residents there will use other hubs. Craig, Ketchikan, even Juneau or Anchorage, but it also there are even smaller communities around Thorn Bay, where Thorn Bay is one of the bigger grocery stores in that area. I am more familiar with that area, so I can speak more confidently about that. That, again, makes it really difficult to do these comparisons. But Heidelberg, I believe, may just have one store, but I'm not confident in that. And I can get back to the committee and if you would like about more details about that particular community.
Representative Gray, you have a follow-up?
Just thank you. I didn't know that.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you. Yeah, so mostly to Representative Gray, there's many communities that have no store.
Right.
So Heidelberg might be one of those, just like Yuzinki and Kodiak Island. You know, you can't drive there, but you can fly there in 6 minutes from one of the air taxis. So everybody shops in town. When I was there, they did have a store, and we would do grocery runs from the air taxi I flew. But it may be that this is maybe a little bit of an artificial number because there is no store. I don't know. But so typically they will buy a month at a time. They'll air taxi in. They'll get the villagers will get their medical done and all that, and then charter the whole plane going back out. And that's their – and they probably bought, you know, in Sitka or wherever. So – and there's a ton of villages that are just like that don't have a store, or if it's a store, it's in the back room of somebody's garage.
Thank you. Through the chair, I appreciate that. It's just the fact that it's 50 times more in Unalaska. And so really, I guess it's more just the discrepancy between Heidelberg being $2,000 and Unalaska being $100,000. And, I mean, I get it that Unalaska has seasonal workers, people there. It's more of a hub, but it's also very small.
Yeah, there's a huge industry in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Grow,
I wanted to go back a little bit in terms of some of the questions, if I could, Mr. Chair. I noticed there's some. If we go back to page 10, for example, and we've got the personal income by per capita personal income by area. Can you discuss averages versus medians when discussing income, and per capita is an average, and it is just a Am I getting to something fruitful here, gentlemen?
Through the chair, Representative Groh, that's a great point, is that the per capita income is indeed an average, meaning that the entire income of an area is then divided by the number of people earning it, or I believe just all residents in per capita, versus a median income would be, you know, the middle, what is the middle 50th percentile person earning. In some of these communities like Bristol Bay, that's why that's an example, there may be people who own fishing vessels who have many times the per capita income that is dragging that number up, versus the average person there, the median person, may actually be earning quite a bit less than $155,000 per year. I would assume they are, that there's just some of those vessel owners are earning a lot more. That's one of, again, one of the challenges in this data. We don't have that detailed data by municipality. We just have this average per capita data.
Follow up.
Representative Groh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, you've talked some about the uncertainty of the estimates tonight. Can you give us an idea of the direction of the size of the uncertainty? I mean, if is there more information you could give us, or informed discussion of that?
Through the chair, Representative Groh, the uncertainty on which particular aspect?
Estimates, for example, of how much an income tax is proposed, as you said, different from the one in front of the committee, versus a sales tax different from the one in front of the committee, would take from incomes at different levels, for example.
Through the chair, Representative Groh, I think with the distributional analysis, I think there's some in the income tax, there's a relatively small degree of uncertainty because the IRS publishes data by income level. So we can pretty clearly look at how much is collected and how many people in Alaska fall into different income brackets. So that data is fairly well developed. It's fairly easy to see how that would work. Sales tax, I think, is much more difficult because since we don't have a statewide sales tax, the federal government administers a statewide income tax, right, essentially, nationwide, but also statewide. So we have data. We don't have a statewide income tax. We just have spotty sales taxes, you know, for various municipalities. So we don't have the data that would make it easy to actually do that analysis. I'm not sure what level, what percentage that might vary of that actual impact. I would expect that the broad pattern would be similar, but I'm not particularly confident about, say, our methodology was to apply the Minnesota numbers. I believe ICER was applying, you know, I don't know if they were using REMI, which is a national economic model, or if they have more Alaska specific data, but generally with that, they're using sort of this national data. Alaska is significantly different from other states, and I don't know that I can quantify the level of uncertainty, but I would say it's much higher for a sales tax than income tax because of the difference in the quality of the data that we have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Gentlemen. Thank you. Please continue.
Mr. Chairman, I think we were actually at our last slide. We left on a very uncertain one. So we're happy to answer any other questions and bring any more information back to the committee that you would like.
Any other questions of the committee? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen, for presenting today. I appreciate the work that you did on helping us understand distributional analysis and answering the questions in a timely manner. I know you've been busy with the budget and the other body. So thank you for doing this for us. Appreciate it. Okay, we've got nothing else to be before the committee tonight, so we will be adjourned as of 7:03 p.m.